If you look at any successful leader, that person is going to embody those three principles. Now, I tell clients, check your resume and don't just look for experience and whether they're typos and let AI write everything. Instead, take a look at whether you represent all three things and how you do that. Craft is all about your resume. Think about caring, though.
Hello and welcome to the Julia and Gino podcast. On today's show, we've got an amazing author and one of my favorite topics since I'm Italian. I like to argue, use my hands, get into it. It's more of like offensive type of game. I love arguing, but we're going to get into persuasion. Jay Heinrichs, he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Thank You for Arguing. Listen to this subtitle. What Aristotle, Lincoln and Homer Simpson can teach us about the art of persuasion. His latest book, Aristotle's Guide to Self-Persuasion, digs into how we can use the same persuasive art to change ourselves. Having worked with clients ranging from Southwest Airlines to universities to NASA, he also advises marketers and advertising agencies. Bloomberg Businessweek says Heinrichs brings the art of persuasion to the world's masters of manipulation. Wow. Adding that he's one of the most entertaining, I would say, because I read his books, and original writers on rhetoric. Welcome to the show, my friend. How are we doing?
That's the best introduction ever. I'm scared.
I don't even know how to. Wow. Jay, I told you off camera that my 14-year-old daughter, we've got six, I gave her the book. I said, Cease, I'm interviewing a New York Times bestseller. It's a big deal. Can you please give me a critique on this book and read the book and give me a couple of answers? The first thing she did when she grabbed it, she's like, Dad, I love the font and the cover is beautiful. And as she's reading it, she's like, he's sarcastic, isn't he? And I said, yes, he is. His sarcasm goes a long way. My first question to you is how and what are the secrets to writing a New York Times bestseller? That's what she asked me.
That is a hard question. If I knew an answer, I'd have more than one New York Times bestseller.
You got one. Most of us don't have any. I've written several books. No, I'm going goose eggs on that one.
That's all right.
I will tell you what. I wrote a book called How to Argue with a Cat.
Oh, that's good.
And talk about irony. I mean, anyway, so I'll tell you one. I think the secret to writing anything and having the courage to do it is to have the courage to write badly. I write terrible first drafts, but I'm a good rewriter and I will keep going until I get this right. And so I would say this to any brilliant 14-year-old who actually reads books. It's like, just write badly. And then because you're such a good reader, you know how to fix your writing. You know what's good. Get it to that point where you think it's good enough.
Her next question is, and I don't want you to answer this because if you answer it, she's going to use it against us. But oh, no. I told her I would. If I wanted to have a second cup of coffee in the afternoon, but my mother said no, how do I convince her otherwise?
I love that question. So actually, I talk with students during the school year several days a week because when they adopt my book, AP classes adopt my Thank You for Arguing. And I teach these kids how to manipulate their parents.
Nope.
Sorry about this. But it's a great way to teach rhetoric because, you know, when you persuade your parents, and if your parents can be persuadable, you then learn to persuade anybody, including markets. So you earn enough money to support your parents when they're old. That is my mission. So I'll tell you the big thing to do if what you want is a second cup of coffee and your mean mother isn't letting you have one.
It's usually the dad, but I'm not going to go there.
The dad lays over now. The dad gives everything now, baby.
Jay's answering.
Okay.
But your daughter did say her mother, didn't she? Okay.
Yes, but there's a lot behind that. I read into things.
She said, yes, but. Yes, let's stick with the yes, okay?
So the thing to do, and this is true with any kind of persuasion, and I got this straight from Aristotle, which is that you need to speak to your audience's advantage. Now, what do I mean by that? You have to say what's good for them. So you first have to find what your audience, in this case, your mother or father, wants or expects. And so you have to think, okay, what is my mother or father going to predict I'm going to say, and how do I not do that? And then secondly, how do I speak to what she wants? Now, there are a couple of things that any kid can speak to right away, and that is fear. Like your mother is fearing for the daughter's safety. Okay, so she's 14-year-old. Is she going to cross the street? More caffeine, the better. I mean, she's got to be alert. The other thing is to come up with, as a reader, she should be able to do her research and show that actually 2 cups of coffee, even for a 14-year-old, I'm no doctor, but she could probably say, here's some pretty good data. It's not going to hurt me. And it seems to be beneficial.
That's awesome.
So you're speaking to what the parent wants, the audience wants, which is that you want your kid to be safe and you want her to be healthy. Prove that this makes her safer and healthier, and she can get all the coffee she wants.
It's interesting.
That's a good answer.
I didn't want to go down this line of questioning, but the way you've positioned it is, nowadays, it seems like persuasion, it probably does the opposite of that with the name calling and the derogatory and not having a discourse, calling somebody a Nazi, authoritarian, a fascist. If I'm trying to persuade somebody, I'm actually insulting them. I'm not even
able to. The kids. I'm like, the second you insult someone, you've already lost your argument. I'm like, you got to think it through.
Or even having an argument. So I'd love to pull this string because I wanted to get into ethos, pathos, logos. I wanted to get into that and the storytelling. I think that's truly important. But this is something societal that we're having to deal with right now. And I want my children to be able to grow up and to be able to not be triggered and have a conversation. And say, I could be wrong, but let's work this out. Let's have a discourse on this.
Well, okay. So we're in a couple of levels here of rhetoric. So One of the easiest ones is to think, who's your real audience? If you are insulting somebody, that's probably not even the audience you want. And if they're insulting you, it's definitely not the audience you want. Just get out of there. So now the other thing is to think about when people are using language that you don't like, especially when it comes in something like name calling. Ask what tense you're in. What are the tenses? Past, present, and future. And again, I got this from Aristotle. Very smart man. He said when people are talking about the past tense, that's what he called forensics, crime and punishment. So what went wrong? Why didn't it work? And who's to blame? That's the past tense. And you hear that all the time in politics. So what somebody did in the past. The present tense has to do with values. Who's good? Who's bad? Who's in my tribe and who's out of my tribe? So if somebody says you're so woke or you're a fascist, what they're really saying is they're not describing you. They're describing what tribe they think you're in, and it's not theirs. So again, there's going to be a lack of trust, and that's a sign that you're talking about two different tribes. Now, if you can prove that you're in the same tribe, that's great. The present tense can help with that. But Aristotle said, his favorite kind of rhetoric, which has to do with what tense you're in, is the future tense, which he called deliberative rhetorics, where you deliberate about choices. So in other words, the future tense is about decisions and choices that affect the future. So you can say, call me whatever you want, but let's talk about how we can fix things. And not to speak too long, but I have to tell you a story, if I may.
Yeah.
I've only had 2 kids, thank God. And my son, our youngest, when he was 15 years old, used up all the toothpaste in the bathroom. And, you know, we live in New Hampshire. Our basement was freezing where the toothpaste was kept. So I'm wearing nothing but a towel first thing in the morning in the bathroom. And I knew the likely culprit was 15-year-old son. So I yell through this closed door, George, he used up all the toothpaste. And I hear this sarcastic voice on the other side saying, that's not the point, is it, Dad? The point is, how are we going to keep this from happening again? Now, I had said to him, talking about the wonders of rhetoric or the dinner table for years, there was no evidence that he'd paid any attention at all. So in a way, he was kind of flattering me. It was a great rhetorical device. But also, he had actually learned, I had said, if you're in trouble, think about what tense you're in and try to switch the future. Say, okay, I screwed up or something went wrong. Let's talk about how to fix it. And so he was making fun of me my lectures about while getting himself out of trouble. He had actually switched to the future. Now, here's another rhetorical principle, which is don't feel like you have to win all the time. Is, you know, those of us handicapped with a Y chromosome, we have to win all the time. If you can just shut up for a little bit or allow yourself to lose strategically, I said, George, okay, you win. now will you please get me some toothpaste? And you know what? He went down into our freezing basement and got a tube. And so who won that argument? When you think about it, like, what's it for? Did I score on points? No. Did I get toothpaste and an errand run by a 15-year-old son? Mm-hmm. That's a triumph. That's one of my greatest rhetorical triumphs.
That's awesome. What a great, I think that's important. And I know you teach a lot of children or young adults, but I think of parents. I think this is the downfall of parents when we were raising children is we get so overworked, overtired that we just blurt out things. And it took me 4 kids and many, many years of marriage to figure out that, wait, I actually have to think about what I'm saying and I can win every argument or I can have the kids do anything I want if I just sit and think for a second. But it did take me a long time. And so what do you teach parents? Because I feel like we need it more than the kids do.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't we? I'm a grandfather now. So,
that's another question is how does it change from parent to grandparent?
Oh, it's so much easier being a grandparent. Yeah. And get off, you know?
I can't wait.
Here you go. I'm done.
It's payback time.
It's payback time. Exactly.
Everything's changing.
But it is. It's hard as a parent, especially I see a lot of younger families and they just are struggling with trying to like, you know, even in school, when we send our children to school, if they don't sit down and be quiet, they don't argue back to the teachers and at home, we're not taught to have a conversation and to properly argue our point and actually we're not allowed to. And
we homeschool, so it seems as if it was supposed to be a democracy, right? Yeah, but we're a constitutional republic. I got elected as the leader, and like they voted me in. That's how it's supposed to be. But it's
very
not like that
our
here.
House. That's true. And they're all Italian, so that doesn't help either.
I don't think it's atypical. This more kids means more chaos, probably. That being said, I think that part of you have to think: what's your real goal here?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do? Now, my parents, I had really good parents. Mm-hmm. But they were, you know, of the World War II generation. And I had the sense that there were 4 of us. Mm-hmm. And I had the sense that their goal was to raise perfect 5-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And then once we turned 5, they had no idea what to do with us. And in those days, it was fine. I'm a boomer. We just went out on the street and they didn't see us for the rest of the day. The parenting wasn't a problem. And so you have to think, what is my real goal here? And self-protection has to be a part of it, clearly. You don't want to stress yourself out. So one of the things that I find with parents these days is they're constantly taught what to be afraid of. Mm. And they're trying to fix everything right at the moment. And one of the things that rhetoric teaches us, this is a really important concept that the ancient Greeks came up with. As you can tell, I talk about the Greeks a lot. They came up with this concept called kairos. Kairos. And it has to do with the art of timing. So there's chronology that the clock just goes around and you never have enough time. And kairos means you wait for the right opportunities and you seize particular moments. And at the most chaotic times, that's when your sense of timing needs to kick in. So the ancient Greeks, their word for chaos, kaos, as they pronounced it, maybe, means a gap or a doorway. It's where our term opportunity comes from, a portal. So now when things are really nuts, one of the most important things to do, and we're talking about society and politics, not just parenting, it's all mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
You know, step back and think, what do I want? What is the actual goal I'm doing? Now, in an argument, when things are crazy, when the kids are talking back or there's just chaos in the room, you think, okay, is this a moment where the kids can learn something? Or is this a moment where I maybe change my behavior? Or is there something I ought to do with the kids right now? Or do I have to? And what's my long-term goal? Now, the other thing about kids is, and I wasn't an ideal parent. My wife was. But I found if they had learned that they could get away with murder by making me laugh. And the thing is, it turns out that when I laughed when they were funny, I was actually teaching them something and I was super aware. Did you find the same thing? I'm like, if you listen
that happens to me. My kids know if they make me laugh, I will say yes to anything. 100%. They've all figured that out. Absolutely. And half of them are adults.
Your kids are going to grow up being funny. I mean, yes. Like, and I'll tell you, for any kind of male, you could be the worst geek, the ugliest person. And if you're funny, women will go for you. I mean, I'm speaking personally.
I'm looking proof.
One woman. who's absolutely beautiful, married me.
I'm with that, actually. I agree with you. There's something about it.
I need to go back to what you said, because I'm going to pull it back into politics again. Mm-hmm. You're saying that somebody needs to have a North Star, or needs to have a reason why or what they're. And when I look at, I don't want to say the Democratic Party, but I'm going to say the Democratic Party. They're flailing right now. They don't have any kind of messaging. Like And I'm trying to understand that, because I want two parties, because one party is just not good for the country. But it seems as if the other party has no messaging, has no correct. Now, they're not really fighting for anything. They're fighting against something. So how do you correct that? Because that's what I see. And they're shedding voters. And it's just incredible to watch in real time. I really want to shift, you know, give them some of your books and have them read this, because it's not real rocket science, because they were really great at it. And all of a sudden, it just seems like as if it's evaporated over the last 4 or 5 years. And can you just explain that to me? Help me out a little bit and make me understand what's going on.
Well, I could give you my take.
Yeah. I'd love your take. Yes.
I'd be a lot richer if I got it all right here, but we're talking about chaos, and at times of chaos, people look for a leader. Mm-hmm. And so even if it's a terrible leader, they'll choose one. Yeah. And I'm not going to go all Hitler on you here, but you know, in Germany, if you look at what made Hitler rise to power, Germany was an absolute mess, right? I mean, the inflation rate was through the roof. Nobody trusted in each other. The society was deeply divided. And so what happens is people will cling to a leader, even a bad one, a person who just stepped up and convinces enough people that he or she, always he, is strong. Now, I think that's what's happened with Trump. And I think what's happening right now with Democrats is, I think we talk too much about messaging, frankly. I'm a message guy.
Yes.
So rhetoric starts with the art of leadership. You had mentioned earlier, Gino, ethos, pathos, and logos. It starts with ethos. Now, ethos is what people believe your character to be, whether they like and trust you, and mostly trust you. If they see you as a leader, you can talk them into a lot more stuff than if they don't trust you, obviously. And so I think what the Democrats are doing now, and I think they need to do it, is to try to find a leader. And you're already seeing people jockeying with different ways they're portraying themselves. So you got the governor of California, you know, playing all the anti-Trump. And then you've got other people who are trying to speak more reasonably and, you know, talk about a future. I think the problem is the Democrats have been badly advised for some time. And one of the things they're advised about is messaging, and their messaging is stale and bad. I think what they ought to be doing right now, and I think they are actually, like, behind the curtain, choosing a leader. Now, that's going to be a 2-3 year process.
When you say messaging, can you give me like some ideas of what you say they're bad messaging? What's the messaging that is bad? Because I'm trying to figure out what it is that you're thinking that their messaging is bad.
Well, the worst kind of messaging makes people feel excluded, make them feel as if they're bad people just by existing.
Yeah.
And so when you're getting all crazy about language, that's going to exclude people. And I'll tell you what, the Republicans are in a really dangerous place right now, because they're doing the same thing. Canceling words, even canceling what you can't, but people are literally having to bureaucrats have to erase climate change from every document. Now, whatever you believe in, and whether you think that's a good idea or not, from a messaging standpoint, it's terrible, because people are going to say, look, I see the planet warming. I read science. Does that make me a bad American? That's what you're saying? I hate you. That's what, you know, the whole tribal messaging is all about. Now, the whole thing over gender has to do with a lot of, you know, identity politics, who's in and who's out. And I think that, you know, an overemphasis on judging other people gets political parties in trouble eventually. And I see the Democrats and Republicans both in deep.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the Republicans are going to find they're in a hot spot. Now, the fact that people don't want to be Democrats doesn't mean that the Republicans are in the catbird seat.
Yes.
There's a lot of independents now are leaning more to the left than they did in the past.
Yes.
Why? Because they don't like the language from either party. I mean, I think that's what I meant by bad messaging.
Yeah.
Not that I want to get back to Hitler. But I mean, let's see the characteristics of the leadership and the charisma and what he used and instilled to captivate a whole country to be able to have to go to war and, you know, end up over 100 million people perishing in World War II. I'm not saying to look at him as a role model, but what were some of the things that he did as far as storytelling, as far as being captivating, as far as body language, as far as what are some of the things that you see that he did that, wow, he was a not a good leader, but a leader of a pretty big country?
Well, I think we're still in the ethos here because that's what this is all about. Not what sure. people okay. see a leader as being. So there are three qualities. And by the way, if you want to be seen as a leader, you need to look at these three qualities. So again, Aristotle taught me this. I call it craft, caring, and cause. Now, Aristotle used Greek words. We can just say craft, caring, cause. So craft means making your audience believe that you can solve the problem at hand. What's the problem in the moment? And why are you the one who's going to fix it? So Hitler, again, he was going to fix the government and stop inflation and get everything to work okay so you don't need a billion marks or whatever it was in order to buy your groceries. Okay, that's craft. The craft has to do with, it's called practical wisdom in rhetoric, which is where it's not just the book learning, though that can be a part of it. Imagine if you're going to get your appendix removed, you're not going to get a doctor just out of med school, right? You want to know how many operations. So it's the book learning, it's the science, but it's also the
experience.
Exactly. Okay. Then there's caring. And caring has to do with your audience's belief that you care for them, that you're disinterested, which means you don't have a dog in this hunt. You only care for the interest of others. Okay. So that's caring. Now, caring has to do with making people believe that you're out for them. You're out for the people. And Hitler said, I'm for the folk, as he called, you know, the German folk. We're going to do what's good for you. Then finally, there's cause. And Aristotle said this is the most important thing of all. Now, Christians know this word, arete, which has to do with virtue, with what you live up to certain principles. You believe in certain things and you live up to them. And Hitler, you know, he was showed himself to be the leader of a tribe. And he represented that tribe, weirdly enough, because it was Austrian, but he was the most German guy, you know, and everybody believed that. So craft, caring, and cause. And if you look at any successful leader, that person is going to embody those three principles. Now, I tell clients, check your resume and don't just look for experience and whether they're typos and let AI write everything. Instead, take a look at whether you represent all three things and how you do that. Craft is all about your resume. Think about caring, though. Like, what is it that shows that you support other people? And as a leader, how you make people under you better. That's caring. And then when it comes to the cause, think, okay, what is this organization's chief cause? You know, maybe shareholder value. Great. Like, make sure you understand that and that you can prove that you're good at that. Those are the three principles.
It's very hard with caring in our society because it's all about me. What's in it for me?
For somebody,
for somebody to put themselves in the mindset of caring and thinking and serving others, that's what makes a true leader. That's what makes a great leader. But for a lot of us, it's a very difficult one to adopt. And they may be saying, Jay, you're full of it. I don't really need to do that. But I agree with you wholeheartedly 100%. On that.
You know, you see a lot of self-help books coming out these days that say, take care of only yourself. And that's like, you know, I can see why that sells books, but I would end up a lot longer in purgatory if I wrote a book.
That's right. 100%. Well, I'm thinking what you're talking about, I know you're talking about leaders in the world, but this also, I think it also goes into the family. Well, yeah, I think with your kids, when your children see you as wise, that, you know, they can help fix, when they see you care and when they see you with the virtue, that's when I think it's easier. And I'm not using the word argue your point, but it's easier to have a family.
I'm trying to keep this in the business realm.
Are.
I'm trying to make
I'm
some
sorry.
Money for people listening to this podcast. The family thing
because
is secondary.
You can have an awesome like career, but yes, go
I'm
home and you can't argue. You if someone does wants a second cup of coffee.
Well, do you mean like the entrepreneur that works 18 hours a day,
yes.
then comes home and tries to say something to the kids, and the kids don't.
They can't figure out why isn't it working at home. I figured it out in the world because I have this awesome book to help me. But it's the same thing at home as in the business.
Well, you know, I do have a kind of a semi-solution to that. And this works for both clients and families. So let's bridge this.
Yes.
I'll start with business because one of the things among my clients are people who are trying to win VC, venture capital, from It's often in competitive situations. And so they'll be in a room, you know, you get your half hour if you're lucky and, you know, move on. So how do you distinguish yourself? And we have a bunch of things I teach. I do workshops and all that. But the last thing I tell them is Marcus Tullius Cicero, who according to himself was the greatest orator in ancient Rome.
According to himself.
He's the guy who said the eyes are the windows to the soul. Mm-hmm. And I tell clients, the last thing you need to think about before you walk in a room is you think, I'm going to love these people and mm-hmm. send love beams out of your eyes. You got to show loving soul right out of your eyes. Now, most of them think I've been chewing some really great gummy or something, but the few who listen will come back yeah. and it's as if they chewed the gummy. They say, this was amazing. I felt the love. Yeah, I think we're going to win the business. Now, with families, I always got myself off the hook as a very flawed father who traveled all the time.
Yeah.
I thought, all right, all I have to do is love them. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to do is love them. And all I have to do is feel the love when I'm angry. As long as I'm feeling that, the kids will know that I love them and that, and they'll forgive me in the long run and won't write any books about me when they grow up.
How's that going?
Well, so far, so good. One's a nurse and the other's a teacher. I think I'm still good.
That's so awesome.
We got down the ethos. Can we go through the logos and the pathos? Because I think those are really important as well.
Yeah. Logos is often interpreted as logic, but really it's more than that. It has mm-hmm. to do with the plan and what you're trying to get out of a situation, you know, the whole goal. You know, so if you look at, you know, John in the Bible writes, in the beginning was the word. That's a mistranslation. What he was really saying is, in the beginning was thought. In the beginning was a plan. You know, it wasn't the word. And I think that that's gotten a lot of people into trouble, you know, thinking there has to be a word. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about logos, it's really important to think. And we're back to messaging in a way. It's like, it's not necessarily even about the words. It's about all the other stuff, like all the ways you're going to bond with your audience and to understand who your audience is and what they believe and expect, what they want. And then on top of that, you have to be able to put together a plan for timing of when you're going to do things and you're going to build a relationship. That is all without words. That's why I wrote a book about how to argue with a cat. It's like, they don't use many words. They can be loud when they use the one or two they have, but it's, you know, the rest of it is all about body language.
Yeah. Attitude.
And, yeah. And smell, very important. Anyway, so I think that that's, so logo, but now logic does come in, obviously. And the thing about rhetoric is fallacies aren't bad if they work. So in the book I just wrote about how to persuade yourself, I had this mission over the course of a year to try to be the first person to do that, some stupid and pointless athletic feat, to become the first person over 50 ever to do it. And so I did that deliberately because it was so stupid. I had to make myself believe it wasn't. How am I going to persuade myself? So, you know, I used a lot of fallacies on myself. And one of it has to do with post hoc ergo propter hoc, which is, you know, it happened before this, therefore it caused it. Mm-hmm. So what that means is whenever there was anything like accidental that happened, I wore a particular pair of shoes. That was it. Those are my lucky shoes. Mm-hmm. If I ran a good time. You see athletes use that fallacy. Yeah. All the time. Yeah. It totally works, by the way. And if you can accomplish something once, even if it was like the conditions were ideal, it was a total fluke that you did it. Imagine a kid trying to shoot baskets, you know, the little kid trying to shoot a basket and everybody's making fun of him. Mm-hmm. He finally gets one basket. Now he's awesome. He's a basketball player. And, you know, that belief makes the kid actually score more baskets and it's no longer a fallacy, but it's a fallacy in the first place. Yes. And so on. So now logic has to do with another element too. And it's just something, I'm not going to get too much in the weeds about this after I read the book. Aristotle wrote about induct. Now in Sherlock Holmes is always bragging about his deduction, you know, his deductive logic. And actually, he was a moron. He was actually talking about inductive logic, which has to do with observing things and then understanding what you're seeing. So when you're doom scrolling on your smartphone and seeing one horrible thing after another, the thing to do is to use inductive logic, which has to do with, okay, what is this really? What am I looking at? Is it real? Is this news real? Is the first thing you can ask yourself. The next thing you ask yourself is, where did it come from? And was there an agenda behind what I'm reading? This is pure Aristotle again, inductive logic. The next thing you say is, okay, what does this mean? Why does this affect me? Is it, you know, you, some kid falls down a well, God forbid, somewhere in Kansas or something. And you have to think, okay, does this mean that wells should be shut down across America? Because the last thing you have to ask is this a trend? Are more kids falling down on wells or fewer kids? I will care about that kid, but what does that mean I'm supposed to be doing about it? Okay, so that's all what logic is. Now, did I say logic has to do with overwhelming people with facts and how brilliant you are at logic? No, that's rhetoric is not about.
And pathos, which is the one that it seems like people are gravitating towards more now because they're pulling the emotional strings, correct?
Yeah. And so this is where social media just causes so much trouble, doesn't it? So social media is all about anger and fear. Now, what's interesting is this would have confused Aristotle, because he said that anger and fear are short-lived emotions. They go away really quickly. And yet social media so much is designed to keep you in that state of anger and fear. And so, now there are emotions that can be very helpful. And we talked about one, which is humor. A very dangerous thing to try to do with the wrong audience. and at the same time, when it comes, if someone is angry with you, I think it's really important to understand why they're angry. And often people are angry because they feel they've been belittled. They, you know, in other words, they feel like it's your, I have to tell you, I once gave a talk to 300 marketing people. And I was talking about how to screw up as a corporation. I'm a master at screwing up. And so when a company does something either stupid or just accidental, the question is, how do you recover from that? And so I had the whole set of things I did. And one of the things I said mistakenly, as it turns out, was don't apologize. Apologies actually are something that people expect so that you belittle yourself. And if you look at some cultures where they'll literally bow, they're making themselves smaller. You don't want to do that because you want people to trust the solution. I'm going to fix this thing. If I'm lying there on the floor crying, I'm not going to fix anything. Well, apologies are expected. That was stupid on my part to say that. But what I should have said is apologies alone won't fix things. Alone. You have to then move right on to the future tense. Anyway, so during the Q&A, a woman stands up and she says, I have been apologizing all my life. And here you are, another man telling me apologies aren't necessary. And I look around the room and I realize, oh my gosh, 2/3 of this audience were women.
Not a good thing. Right?
And that taught me something. It's like, I actually went and for a new edition of my book, I wrote in, definitely apologize. But then there are other things we need to do.
Speaking of women, I'm curious about what your relationship is with your wife. Like, what was that? What is that like?
Well, she wants to know, did you drive her nuts? That's what she wants to know. Were you really annoying? And did she put up with you? Or that's just underneath. If I'm digging underneath the question, that's what I think you are.
I think she may be in hearing distance here. Because otherwise I would say, I'm a saint. But you know what's interesting is, and I get the sense that you two are the same way.
Yes.
That you argue.
Yes.
Now, there's really good research on this that shows that couples who argue in a particular way don't get divorced. They have 6 kids and they still love each other.
Yeah.
So now there's a difference between arguing and fighting. And I think people conflate the two. They think they're the same. So now in an argument, you're actually trying to win over the other person to make a choice. You're going to fix something. Yes. You're going to plan something and you're going to try to get your way if you can. But the idea is you're going to do it in a way that the other person thinks that she benefits. Now, we argue a lot. We genuinely do. But we try to do it with humor and some insiderish language. I mean, you know.
Of course.
And that really helps them. So it's the people who fight in order to prove that the other person is a jerk.
Yes.
Which is a way of saying, I'm an idiot for marrying you. I don't know why people even do that. The other thing is, you know, I'm not big necessarily on gratitude because I think gratitude isn't something you just do. You know, there has to be a reason to feel grateful. But I honestly feel really grateful. I married a really wonderful woman, and she has forgiven me for all my faults. Now, the way she forgives me, though, is she makes it very clear what those faults are and how I might fix them. And then we have a useful argument with a lot of pathos sometimes. We do raise our voices. And by the way, I grew up in a very loud family.
Yes.
And she grew up in a very quiet one. So I, you know, now the good news is because we're both 70, she's deaf. I can yell all I want.
That's awesome. I love that you say that, though, because I think a lot of couples, especially the younger generation, is afraid to, they use the word argue or fight. Same. They don't see the difference. And so I think that's really important.
Jay, we would be driving the minivan and all six kids are in the back and we're having a discussion. I may be a little vocal when I talk. I'm loud. I'm Italian. I sing opera. And the kids are like, why are you and mom always fighting? Yeah. And we're not fighting. We're just having a discussion.
Well, that was our oldest. She thought we were fighting for years. And I'm not kidding. And finally we got, because it was mom's house. And she's like, I'm just so tired of it. And she was little. And I said, what? She's like, you and dad just fight every time we're in the car. And I thought, oh no, honey, we're actually just having a conversation. And it was so interesting that I think a lot of parents are cautious about not fighting in front of children and so on. And they need to see, first of all, that was kind of funny because I had to explain that we were just literally, I think we were talking about politics, which is even fun because we just get very animated. But also at the same time, we're talking about this. It's important that the kids see you argue and see you work through it. And see you use humor, as you said, because that's really, really helpful when you're arguing your point, especially to win. I usually win. Okay. But it's good for them because it's part of their development. And I think a lot of people are like, if you ever have a fight, leave the house. Don't let the kids see it. I'm like, I don't know about that. But I do. The fighting and the argue, those two words are very different. And it's really important that people learn the difference. I agree. I'm so happy you brought that up.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you enforce that. And it is, I think that's one of the secrets to any relationship, not necessarily a marriage.
Exactly.
It's understanding that. So I think this is just to really broaden this out, like to the whole world. People are going to disagree. Yep. And the idea that disagreement itself is bad.
Yes.
That's where democracies die. Yes. And, you know, you can't have economies. There has to be a certain kind of trust in this idea that people can disagree and that a disagreement can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Agreed. Well, we're on the same team. When you're talking about it, arguing, we're on the same team. Right. Fighting, we're on different teams. Like, you know, when you're married, you're on the same team. And that's the way I'm thinking about it. So like,
well, I think too, you mentioned you don't have to win every argument. It's important to be like, you know what,
Gino, I'm going to rewind this in a couple of weeks. I'm going to say, Julia, you don't have to win every argument.
I'm so good at it that you don't even notice.
Oh, yeah.
You don't even notice.
This ninja here.
When like all of a sudden you're like, you think you won an argument. It's because I let go.
Women are better at that. I think women are better at that. Being traditionally out of power for so many thousands of years.
We don't want to be in power. It's a secret. We don't want to be in power.
The big thing is that you can win. I mean, the thing is, what is a win? And I think it's really important at the beginning of any argument, you have to think, what do I actually want?
Yes.
So what, and this is back to who your real audience is. I tell kids, high school kids, now that they're all back in school, except for the homeschoolers, they look around you.
Yeah.
You have some peripheral vision because the person who is yelling at you or the person you're arguing with may not be the person you want to persuade. Mm-hmm. You may just want to win by being the grown up in the room, like the one who is making the most sense and not losing it. You know, that works on social media. You know, not all the time because social media really rewards the people who are crazy.
Right.
That being said, over the long term, you're going to regret it if you're just the kind of influencer who makes people angry. Mm-hmm. That's not going to last long. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to be the grown up. And if everybody does that enough, I think we'll have a better society.
Oh, that's awesome. Jay, where can the listeners learn more about you, buy your books, just website?
Yes to all the above.
I know you've got extensive stuff. I know you've written tons of books. I'm trying to wrap my mind around. And you're 7 years old. You don't look like you're 70. You look like a day over 50. Seriously. Right. I was like, wow. I mean, I can't believe the guys at 7 years of age, most people are like, I'm not really sure about it. But man, you're cranking along. That is awesome.
Oh, thank you. I only told you about my birthday to get that compliment. So thank you.
Your wife sent us a note. That's why.
She does that. So I've written several books all on rhetoric. If you look up my name, you'll find my books. They've been all the bookstores and, you know, Amazon and all the other places. I have a Substack newsletter for anybody who does Substack. And if you don't, you just get the newsletter. And it has all to do with persuasion of all kinds, including self-persuasion. And I'm on all the fine social media places as well, being the grown-up in the room.
Baby,
we're going to argue about who's wrapping it up.
Like, we have to teach our kids how to do. And this is something that's really important. Now, Jay, his writing is eloquent. It's sarcastic. It's humorous. And it's just so well written. I mean, it's, you can pull it out. And as I was reading it, I'm going through all the different stuff. We didn't touch upon storytelling. We didn't touch upon so many other topics in the book, which I wish we could. But I really would tell anybody listening to this, go out and buy the book. It's an amazing book.
Oh, you're too kind. And I got to tell you, your kids are lucky to have you.
Thank you. We'll tell them that when we go inside.
Yeah. Say I said so. And then tell that 14-year-old of hers to read the book.
Thanks.
I'll give
Jay.
Her the second cup of coffee. On you. No, it's because it was you.
That's dude, the great. Coffee we go through in a week, you're killing me now. I go through like 15 pounds a week. They all drink coffee. And now they're all starting to drink wine. I mean, you're killing me here. We've got to argue at the food bill now.
Oh, come on. They're Italian. They have to have the wine and the coffee. It's,
it goes together.
Yeah. Such a pleasure.
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks, Jay. We appreciate it. And for anybody listening out there, just thank you for spending part of your day with us. And we'll see you on next week's Julie and Gino podcast. Take care, everyone.